From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Russian economy is in big trouble. The ruble is sinking as oil prices drop and sanctions from the West bite. But Vladimir Putin radiates confidence, saying the economy will bounce back in time, that the West is doing all it can to undermine Russia, trying to declaw the Russian bear. Tensions continue over Ukraine and Crimea. With troubled relations between Russia and the EU and the U.S., what will Putin do? This hour on Point, Vladimir Putin and Russia's troubles. You can join us on air or online. What do you see happening here? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. And joining me first today from Moscow is Michael Birnbaum. He's the Moscow bureau chief for The Washington Post. Michael Birnbaum, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks so much for having me.
Good to have you with us. Let's begin by going to a clip from Russia's leader. Last week, speaking at his annual press conference, President Vladimir Putin said that the West is trying to attack the Russian bear. Here we go.
Maybe they will leave him alone? No, they will not. They will always try to chain him. And as soon as they succeed, they will pull out his fangs and claws.
So, Michael Birnbaum, again, Vladimir Putin, and here trying to cast the West as the attacker behind Russia's current woes. Why don't you paint us a picture of what has gone on in recent weeks with the ruble down and the economy outlook not very good?
Well, it has been a tremendously dramatic couple of weeks for the Russian economy and for the Russian ruble. The ruble is down about 45% this year, and last week, last Monday and Tuesday, it really just completely slid into the basement in a single day. In a couple of hours on Tuesday of last week, it went down 20%. And it's since recovered somewhat. But basically, what we have right now is the ruble tied very closely to the price of oil, which has been going down since June highs. It's lost. It's also lost about 50%, and the Russian economy is very dependent on oil exports. We also have the accumulating effect of Western sanctions against Russia because of its actions in the Ukraine conflict, and that's making it hard for banks and companies to refinance to get more dollars. And it's aggravating what would already have been a really big problem with this drop in oil prices.
Now, Michael, apart from the 3-hour, 10-minute, 1,200 reporter press conference that Vladimir Putin gave last week, what do you think is Russia's response to this new round of sanctions behind the scenes? Are any heads rolling, any shuffles taking place?
Well, we haven't seen any heads roll, and Putin thus far has said that he's not going to move to change Russian economic leadership. What we have seen are attempts to encourage Russian businesses to conserve their cash in rubles, to switch their dollars into rubles to help prop up the exchange rate. And that actually does seem to be helping in the last couple of days. That doesn't help the long-term issue, which is that if oil prices stay relatively low and sanctions stay in place, there really is just going to be a tremendous pinch on the Russian economy.
Who does this weak economy really hurt? How's the average Russian person reacting to things right now? Putin is still extremely popular, right?
That's right. Well, his approval ratings are still near record highs. They're above 80%. And so far, you know, even talking to people on the street last week, you didn't see people. You saw people concerned about the economy. You didn't see people particularly angry with Putin. We're just at the beginning of this. Prices are going up. Inflation is rising. The predicted inflation rate for next year is about 10%. That's the official rate. It could well be quite a bit higher. That means that everybody will see higher prices for food, for parts of their everyday life. And that means that their wages are just going to be buying less.
Let's listen again to something that President Putin said last week as regards the economic outlook, and then I'll ask you to come back to that.
Our economy will overcome this situation. How long will it take? At the worst scenario, I think about 2 years. After that, growth is inevitable.
So, Michael Birnbaum, are people buying that? I mean, are people as confident as the Russian leader?
There are a lot of economists who are not as confident as the Russian leader. Basically, he's gambling that the price of oil will really rebound within the next 2 years, and with it, basically uplifting the rest of the Russian economy. That is possible, but nobody really knows. There are some economists I've talked to who think that, you know, he really could be right. But the, you know, ordinary Russians, again, they're not deeply involved in economic policy. A lot of people, you know, just earn in rubles. They buy Russian products. They're not quite as affected by all of this turmoil as the middle class or the richer strata of Russian society.
Is there any public sentiment from people that Russia needs to change course politically to avoid further alienation or sanctions or some sense of a policy change when it comes to its actions, say, in Ukraine or Crimea?
Well, that's the million-dollar question or 50 million ruble question. I don't think that there is a lot of – you don't see backing down in rhetoric from the top. Putin last week at the press conference was very defiant about his relationship with the West. He didn't show any sign of regrets of his course over the past year. You do see signs of a bit of compromise in eastern Ukraine. There's a ceasefire there at the moment that's working better than any ceasefire before this. That may simply be because it's winter, but it could be a Russian attempt to ease tensions a little bit so that sanctions are relieved.
Well, thank you so very much, Michael Birnbaum, Moscow Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Jackie.
Now joining us from Moscow is Masha Gessen. She's an American-Russian journalist. She's written a lot about Russia and President Putin. She's the author of The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Masha Gessen, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, Jackie. Good to be here.
It's good to have you from Moscow. I know you just went back a few days ago, but I'd like to ask you, how much do you see? This is the rockiest year that Vladimir Putin has had in 15 years of power, be it as prime minister or president. How much do you see the current situation as really being at the fault of Vladimir Putin?
Well, first of all, we think it's the rockiest year that Vladimir Putin has had. He certainly doesn't feel like it. He feels it's probably his decisive year. It's the year that he's really sort of come into his own. It's the year that he's waged his decisive war. I think he feels very much on top of things, and I think he's just as taken by surprise by the economic crisis as he looks to be, which is really disturbing. Because in
Well, I just was wondering if the collapse in the ruble is a matter of poor economic management, or is it in any sense attributable to personal faults or faults of character, belligerence, for example, paranoia?
Well, those are very difficult things to separate out. But, I mean, the fall, we're sort of falling into this trap of talking about the very bad day that the ruble had last week as being the Russian economic crisis. The Russian economic crisis has really been going on for about a year. The Russian economy has been facing stagflation for the last year. The first month that we saw food prices rise by 10% within 1 month was July of this year. Right. The currency has been slipping all year long. Falling oil prices and sanctions have certainly contributed to Russia falling off the precipice, but Russia had placed itself at the edge of this precipice all on its own, without the sanctions and without the falling oil prices. And that certainly has been the result of the corrupt system that Vladimir Putin has built. And, you know, that's very difficult. That's the place where it's impossible to separate his politics from his personal flaws. They are one and the same.
Well, I don't want to fall into that trap, Masha, but the Russian people perhaps may be. There's an independent poll out of Moscow last week that we heard about in an NPR story that said his approval ratings are still very, very high. You've been back a few days. I'm just wondering, is anyone telling you that they're anxious or that there is a reaction to this that shows that it's a game changer in any way?
Okay, first of all, let's debunk the myth of an independent poll out of Moscow. There's no such thing. Right. I mean, we are dealing with a country that has had full-on authoritarian rule for about 15 years, and it's really veering and becoming a totalitarian country. You can be as independent a pollster as you want to be. That doesn't mean people are going to talk to you freely. And I don't even mean that people hide their convictions. What I mean is that this is, you know, we're dealing with a totalitarian psychology of people having been robbed, as Hannah Arendt once said, of the very ability to form convictions, right? It's a matter of survival in this country to be able to mouth the line that you're supposed to mouth. So that's what the polls measure. So I would just really like to set that aside. As to your question, you know, do people feel anxious? Everybody's terrified. Everybody I've talked to is absolutely terrified and, you know, really feels like the world is collapsing.
Well, one wonders if then there's any sense of reassurance in some of the narratives that Vladimir Putin is relying on to get him through, whether it's nationalism or just that time is on the side of the Russian people.
There's nationalism. It's a mobilizing ideology more than anything else. It's not going to get people through hard times, but it may make them, you know, sort of make them have an easier time with a hard time.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the U.S., Russia, and the troubled ruble. You can join the conversation. How do you see the U.S. and Russia relationship? And Masha Gessen is with me from Moscow. She's joining us by Skype from there. She's a Russian-American journalist and the author of The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Masha, we were talking just before the break about the public and the narrative they're relying on. Let's go outside Russia. Earlier, Putin seemed confident that Russia would make it through the economic costs of Western sanctions. Do you think he still has that same level of confidence?
Sure. I mean, he's been watching his own television for the last 15 years. And, you know, the quotes that you have used so far in the program are some of the saner quotes of his on the economy. My favorite is the one where he tried to explain that Russia is actually benefiting from the fall of the currency, because he said, you know, it used to be that we would sell a dollar's worth of oil and we would get 32 rubles in the budget. And now, at that point, it was 48 rubles per dollar. He said, now we sell a dollar's worth of oil and we get 48 rubles in the budget. So the budget is actually benefiting. I mean, this is the level of economic expertise and economic, the level of the economic message is even worse, that he's putting out to the public.
You have written that you see Vladimir Putin as someone who, as some world leaders do, is very intuitive, that he basically, I don't want to put words in your mouth, acts first, thinks later. Is that too extreme to talk about your view of his actions?
No, I'd say that's pretty accurate. I think he rules by instinct. I think he has very good instincts where holding on to power is concerned. I think he is not a well-educated or well-informed man. He is extremely isolated and increasingly isolated, which is the fate of most dictators. Absolutely. He rules by instinct. And actually, I want to go back for a second to something that you talked about at the beginning of the program about whether heads have rolled. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about this is that it's true. Nobody has been fired in the economic sector, but Putin has fired his longtime ally, who used to be the press minister and who for the last few years has been running one of the big state media holdings. Mikhail Lesin, he has been fired. So Putin clearly views this as a public relations problem, as a propaganda problem, and not as a structural economic problem, which is what it really is.
Masha, let's take a question here. Dmitry is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Dmitry.
Hi, Jackie. Hi, Masha. Several points. Unfortunately, from my experience coming from Russia about 30 years ago, it seems like Russians genuinely have delusions of greatness, and mostly it expresses itself in being able to take abuse from their own government. So in that sense, unfortunately, I think Putin is very, very secure. I think people will queue in lines and think that just eating bad food and then being miserable is part of great Russian identity.
Okay, more of a comment, I would say, than Dmitry, I guess, than a question.
Yeah. And another thing is that I think West actually can be quite secure due to the level of non-professionalism in Russia. I think nobody is a professional. And whoever is supposed to press the atomic launch button will find out that it's rusty, or that the other person who is supposed to be there, present, had problem with his car and not showing up.
Thank you very much, Dmitry. We appreciate that. And I don't know about the atomic power, but what about the West, Masha Gessen? Let's listen to a comment last week. Certainly, Vladimir Putin has put that front and center. Here's a comment from his press conference.
After the fall of the Berlin Wall, didn't they tell us there wouldn't be any NATO expansion to the east? But it started immediately. They decided they were the winners. They were an empire now, and the rest of the world were vassals.
Do you think there will be any change on policy as regards Crimea or Ukraine?
I mean, will Western powers change their policy?
No. Do you think that given all of this, might Vladimir Putin rethink his policies on Crimea or Ukraine? And how worried is he about European Union sanctions?
Yeah, I don't see him retreating from Crimea or Ukraine for two reasons. One is that ideologically he can't retreat. I mean, he can't improve the economy. So the only thing he can rely on is whipping up more nationalist fervor, more mobilization in society. So that means stepping up the war effort, not stepping back from the war effort. The other thing is that he doesn't really see a causal relationship between his actions in Ukraine and the economy. In a sense, he's right. Again, I want to stress that the Russian economy was in huge trouble before sanctions and before the oil prices started falling. And these were just the sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. But he believes that the sanctions have had an impact, but he also believes that the sanctions were imposed by the West because the West wants to do something bad to Russia, not in response to Crimea. What he said in his press conference was that the West used the Crimea as a pretext to impose sanctions that they wanted to impose for a long time. And I think he absolutely sincerely believes that.
All right. Thank you very much, Masha Gessen. Would you just stand by there for a moment in Moscow? We'd like to bring in another voice. And Anders Aslan joins us now from Washington. Anders Aslan is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He was an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine in the 90s. He's a former Swedish diplomat, and he's been looking at the Russian economy for a long time. Anders Aslan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jackie.
So let's talk about the underpinnings of the Russian economy. Vladimir Putin has put a lot into oil and gas drilling. What are the dimensions at the center of the ruble crisis in Russia, and how great is its dependency on oil and gas drilling?
It is great. There are three central numbers here. Oil and gas accounted for 2/3 of Russia's exports last year, 50% of the state revenues, and 20% of a gross domestic product. And President Putin has only stuck to oil and through the massive corruption and a very bad business environment. Economic activity has been ever more concentrated to oil and gas, and neither oil nor gas production has been increasing in recent years. So it's all been about prices.
So if all the emphasis has been put on oil and gas, where is the economy vulnerable? We're talking resource rich, but how about the phrase, do you want something made in Russia? What about manufacturing?
going nowhere, or rather declining. Russia had a very good high-tech internet industry, and that is going down now because of increased regulation. Russia, in Russia, Amazon and Google and so forth did not dominate. Instead, Russia had its own internet companies that were quite outstanding. Now they are sharply down because of new regulations on the internet. So it's not only that Putin is not stimulating, he's killing off these industries.
Anders, you've also written that Russia is having its Lehman Brothers moment right now. Could you explain that?
Yeah, what happened at the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy in September 2008, that was that international liquidity froze. Nobody was prepared to lend money to any other country. And what has happened with the financial sanctions that the U.S. introduced in July and soon afterwards the European Union against Russia, it means that money now goes in a one-way street out of Russia. Nobody brings in money to Russia. And that means that Russia this year is losing net $130 billion of reserves that are now down to about $410 billion. And half of this, I would argue, is not readily available because it's not with a central bank and not fully liquid. So all of a sudden, Russia looks very vulnerable in international finance.
What are the implications of that? Why should, to be frank, people care if the Russian economy is weak? I mean, Russia wants to be a global power, yes, but if the ruble falls, I mean, what does that mean for someone in Ohio?
Well, for example, it means that the Russian GDP falls from $2 trillion to $1 trillion. In that case, Russia cannot afford all its military adventures. I do think that we are seeing a softening on Russia's attitude towards eastern Ukraine. President Putin has avoided talking about eastern Ukraine, and he has no clear commitment what he's doing there. There doesn't seem to be any strategy. So although his language is hardline, it's less hardline than we saw early in the summer. And he has, for example, stopped the South Stream gas pipeline project that would go from Russia through the Black Sea to the Balkans, because Russia does not have the money. He will have to cut much more than he now realizes.
All right. Let's take a question here. Leonie is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Leonie.
Yes. Hi, Jackie. I have two questions. Basically, one of them, what kind of a goal Mr. Putin have in Ukraine? What is it actually he wants to achieve? And I'm yet to understand that. And the other question, what kind of chance he's got without a diplomacy, a chance to achieve his goal?
All right, let's put that to Masha Gessen. Masha, could you hear those questions?
I just heard the first question about his goal in Ukraine. What was the second question?
What he's hoping to achieve out of that policy, sort of follow the first one.
Right. I don't think he has a clear goal in Ukraine. I think he has a mission, which is a little bit different. He views Russia as fighting a war against the expansion of Western civilization. He views Russia as standing up for what he envisions as traditional values and counteracting the expansion of Western values, the idea of universal human rights. The anti-gay campaign is very much a part of that. The idea that gay culture and equal rights for LGBT people will be a part of Western policy if Ukraine goes west and if Ukraine joins the Western world. All of that, it's a huge mess of ideology. And Russians really believe that they're fighting the United States in Ukraine. So it's not, even contrary to what some American pundits say about Russia's strategic interest in Ukraine, that's really not what that war is about from Putin's point of view or from Russia's point of view. That war is about a conflict between Russia and the United States, and it's as though Ukraine didn't exist.
All right, let's take another question here. Peter is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to On Point, Peter.
Yes, yes. Hello, everybody. Well, I'm first of all very excited you brought this topic, this show. I support Putin, no question, but any of your questions has simple, simple answer. First of all, in Ukraine, it's true Russia fighting with U.S. I think U.S. fight with Russia. And sometimes simple questions matter. For example, if you think Russia deserves sanctions for what they do in Ukraine, I myself and all the Russians say, wow, why? What kind of sanctions U.S. deserve for what they did in Iraq, in Middle East? Isn't it right? So another thing about press conference 2 days ago was so amazing, so open. About 13,000 journalists. I watched all of them, and I saw tough questions. Guy from Ukraine almost screaming to the Putin. Putin took every question. I remember from BBC, gentleman was asking, Putin started flying plane with threatening us. And he explained very easy.
Said, okay, Peter, let's boil it down a little bit. You say that you're an unequivocal supporter. Could you succinctly tell us perhaps why? What is the basis of your support?
What do you mean critical? I know. I call in my relatives. I call in my brother. I know sometimes.
And you say that because you, how are you supporting?
Because supported? The policy, because we have to defend ourselves, you know. It's simple.
It's a matter of defense.
What do you think this NATO base is doing in Baltics? What do you think they're doing over there?
All right. Thank you very, very much, Peter. Masha Gessen, could you react to that? Certainly, Peter is talking about being a supporter of Vladimir Putin's and, again, saying that the NATO bases are too close. NATO has intentions and designs on Russian territory. That kind of sentiment, you must hear that.
Yeah, I think that was a very good illustration of what I was saying just a little bit earlier, that Russians view the war in Ukraine as a war that Russia is fighting against the West and against Western expansion.
Anders Ashland, could we say, is there any wiggle room that Vladimir Putin has here? Is there something he can do with the central bank, refinancing loans, getting help elsewhere? How does he pull this one out?
The only wiggle room he has, but is now trying to utilize, is to get some money from China. But as the world looks today, everybody's afraid of U.S. financial regulators. After BNP Paribas was fined, the French bank was fined $9 billion by U.S. financial regulators. Everybody is afraid of providing money in dollars, because if you are providing money in dollars, then you are subject to the U.S. Regulators. So President Putin is in a much tougher spot than people believe. And this is what makes the sanctions, the financial sanctions, so effective. But let me turn to this question about Russia's attack on Ukraine. First of all, we know that Russian special forces started working on February 22nd, the day when Yanukovych left Kiev.
Mm-hmm. We've got just
Crimea.
About a minute here, Anders. Just want to tell you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this was a straightforward attack. And then in eastern Ukraine, the same. This is a military aggression of a kind that we have not seen since Adolf Hitler marched in Europe, and Russia has violated at least half a dozen of international treaties that have been ratified.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook. And we're talking this hour about new sanctions against Russia and the spiraling economy there. You can join the conversation. Could the West be pushing Putin too far with these sanctions, backing him into a corner? Masha Gessen is with us. She's the author of The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Masha's joining us by Skype from Moscow, and also Anders Ashland. He's joining us from Washington. He's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute of International Economics. He was an economic advisor advisor to Russia in the early 90s. Masha and Anders, would you stand by a moment? We have talked a little bit, Anders, about what U.S. bank regulators might do, but we haven't talked a whole lot yet about what the White House might do. Last spring, this year, there were certain sentiments expressed by none other, I think, than Sarah Palin, that the U.S. president was playing marbles and the Russian president was playing chess. And President Obama turned that around, speaking with CNN's Candy Crowley in an interview this Sunday. He said that Putin has not won anything.
There was a spate of stories about how he was the chess master and outmaneuvering the West and outmaneuvering Mr. Obama and this and that and the other. And right now, he's presiding over the collapse of his currency, a major financial crisis, and a huge economic contraction. That doesn't sound like somebody who has rolled me or the United States of America.
Anders Oslin, could you react to that? You were talking a little bit about the European position just before our break, and now I'd like you to talk about our president's position.
Well, basically, I agree with him, but I would start with saying that President Putin does not play chess. He plays judo. His game is improvisation, it's tactics, it's surprise. There's no sign of any clear strategy in his behavior. And as Masha emphasized, he really wants to keep himself uninformed. And very strikingly, he takes all the information from the intelligence agencies, nothing about the economy. And what we are now seeing, returning to President Obama, it is that these financial sanctions that were imposed in July are far more effective than had been expected. Other oil currencies have also fallen, but only by one-third or so of what the Russian ruble has fallen. So it's the combination of falling oil prices, bad Russian economic policy, and the Western sanctions that has brought down Russia into this serious economic crisis. And I really think that this is something that will hit the Russian economy and President Putin hard next year.
Masha Gessen, you've been in Moscow just a few days. Is anyone talking about the way the U.S. has rethought sanctions against Cuba? Does that play into the picture or the conversation at all over there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that there's actually a strong emotional reaction to the lifting of sanctions against Cuba. A lot of people perceive it as retaliation for Crimea. It's seen as a sort of annexation of Cuba by the United States, because Russia has traditionally, or this generation and the previous generation of Russians, has thought of Cuba as sort of part of their own. Cuba, our love. I mean, that's a song that we all grew up with. So there's a real sense of surprise, and there's a really strong emotional reaction that cuts along political lines in this country.
Cuba, our love. Do you remember any of the lyrics to that, or the point of it?
I don't. I'm sorry, but anyway, it's a sense of ownership, but it's a sense of a great affinity. Obviously, very few people have who live here have been to Cuba, but a lot of people feel a particular affinity for Cuba.
Let's take another call. Dennis is calling from New Orleans. Welcome to On Point, Dennis.
Hey, Jackie. Really enjoy your show. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Your question or your comment?
Just have a quick comment, if I may, as a dual citizen of U.S. and Russia. For U.S., it's about Western values, monetary freedom of speech, etc. And I think for Russian, it's about national pride and patriotism. It is certainly not about money for Mr. Putin, who is a very strong historic figure. He's simply above any currency here. I think it's all about perception as well.
Okay. Thank you for that comment, Dennis. And let's put that to Anders. You know, one wonders, Anders, if any leader can really be above currency troubles. You were talking about moves into Europe and this being one of the more dramatic, we're talking now about Crimea, annexation since World War II. But what about this notion that the country or its leader could be above economic crisis and that maybe it just welds people together more tightly?
Well, there's much to that, but there is also a limit to how far the national pride can take you. The most recent example we have seen in Europe, that was Slobodan Milosevic of Yugoslavia and Serbia. He started war in 1991, and he was ousted in 2000. Since 92, he was subject to massive UN economic sanctions, and Serbia was bombed by NATO in 99. So it took a long time to take down Milosevic. And in the end, it was his population who did so for a number of reasons, including economic misery. So if you really get going on national pride, you can cause a lot of damage to your nation.
Mm-hmm. Any immediate signs of stress that you're seeing, Masha? I mean, one wonders if Russia could return to some of the shortages that it saw, I think, at the end of the 1980s, where you read about, you know, things like extraordinary lines for basic necessities, even household items like bathroom tissue or foodstuffs. Do people even think about that sort of thing anymore with an economy that's 30% dependent, as I understand it, on imports?
Yes. I mean, I think people are not talking about shortages as much as they're talking about their experience of poverty. But, you know, you have to remember that even though Russia has lived through a period of unprecedented prosperity in this century, in the 1990s, most Russians came face-to-face with poverty or slipped into poverty, at least for some period of time. And that's become suddenly a very important part of the cultural conversation here, is people's lived experience of being very, very poor. Suddenly you're seeing on the social networks, you're seeing a lot of people remembering, you know, buying that last carton of milk. And having somebody come over and drink it thoughtlessly and that sort of thing. So I think people, this is something that people pushed out of their minds in the aughts and the 2010s, and that suddenly come back sort of roaring into people's minds. And it's a sense of absolute terror and extreme uncertainty.
All right. Let's take another question here. Steve is calling from Austin, Texas. Welcome to On Point, Steve.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. My point was, do we really need to restart a Cold War? I don't mean to disregard Ukraine's rights, but as an American, it seems like with Russia, we don't want to restart a nuclear arms race. We need to tackle the climate problem, and we need to contain Iran. And we need to keep them out of a close alliance with China. So to me, these are really big problems that, you know, make Ukraine seem peripheral.
All right.
To our interests.
Thank you, Steve, and thanks for that context. Anders, let me ask you about that. Steve makes some good points about an overextended U.S. foreign policy commitment. We haven't, of course, spoken about Afghanistan or fighting ISIS or some of the other things on the agenda here. What about that? How important is Ukraine?
Well, I would rather put it like this, that Russia is very weak, and that President Putin is heavily overplaying his hand. Therefore, no Cold War is needed. And if you take the simple numbers, Russia's GDP today is slightly over $1 trillion. The U.S. GDP is 17 larger times larger. President Putin himself mentioned last week that Russia's defense expenditures are only $50 billion, while the U.S. Just passed a defense budget of $575 billion, 11 and a half times more. So Russia isn't there. And the point is simply that President Putin needs to realize that he has heavily overplayed his hand.
Okay, we'll take one more question here. Tom is calling from Boston. Welcome to On Point, Tom.
Hi, Jackie. Just a couple of questions for your guest. It seems to me, and I don't know if they think this, that there may be some sort of an agreement between the U.S. and the Saudis to keep the price of oil low It undercuts ISIS quite a bit. It gives some bite to the sanctions against Russia, and it helps the U.S. economy. I don't know what they think about that. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Anders, I'll let you take that one.
Yeah, I'm happy to deal with that. When you say that to people here in the U.S. administration, they say, oh, we just hope that we were that smart and that we had such good cooperation with the Saudis. Indeed, you're right. It looks like it. But I don't think that's quite the case. What we have here are massive market forces, and each country looks to their own interests. The Saudis are interested in defending their market share in the oil market, and it wants other countries to cut production, which they have not been prepared to do. And in the U.S., you really have a freewheeling market where all kinds of small companies have suddenly produced a lot of shale oil.
All right. Thank you for that. Masha Gessen, I'm wondering what you're going to be looking for. I mean, what might Vladimir Putin's next moves be? Obviously, we think this is something of a turning point. Maybe he doesn't. But you must be trying to chart some kind of course to his actions here.
Well, that would be sort of a losing proposition, considering that he's charting no kind of course. It would be overconfident on my part to try to chart a course for him. My prediction, however, is that we will see him lash out more. I don't see him doing anything but finding more ways to be more aggressive and to try to sort of whip the population into another frenzy. I'm very scared about what he's going to do next. It's not going to be good news.
All right, we'll take another call here. Philip is calling from Syracuse. Welcome to On Point, Philip.
Okay, hi. Let's see. My question has to do with Crimea. And if we look at it from the Russian point of view, if Ukraine had joined NATO, Russia's major naval port would have been in a NATO country. So if you look at it from that point of view, you can see very well why they felt they needed to take Crimea for their own security purposes. So that's my comment.
All right. Masha Gessen, I'll let you react to that.
Well, a couple of things. One is that actually joining NATO was not on the table. NATO expressed no interest in having Ukraine join, nor was Ukraine in negotiations about joining NATO. What we were talking about, what Russia reacted to, was a partnership agreement with the European Union. Right, a financial and cultural agreement that with rather sort of soft consequences. So it's very much, again, it's an ideologically motivated war. It's not a strategic conflict. And I think that's a really important thing to understand, just to be able to understand what Putin is going to do next. He is driven by ideology, not by considerations of strategy.
And when it comes to Ukraine, Masha, my understanding is that more people in Ukraine now favor its being a part of NATO over the course of this year, that sentiment is inching up to join.
Well, that's not particularly surprising, is it? I mean, part of the country has been bitten off by Russia, and nobody has invented good ways of dealing with that except for trying to join NATO. Not that that's foolproof either. So that's another point about this whole conversation. Sort of when we start talking about how understandable it is that Russia invaded Ukraine, that completely denies the existence of Ukraine as a country. It's a sovereign state. It's a state that for the last 20 years has had a transitional form of government. It's not a functional democracy, but it is a state in which people have had a way of expressing their will. And their will very clearly is to be more closely allied with the West than with Russia and to be in some way protected from Russian aggression. And as we have seen, they have very good reason to fear Russian aggression.
All right, let's see if we can sneak in one more call. John is calling from Richmond, Vermont. Just very quickly, John.
Hi, very quickly. We're not in the same conditions as the old Cold War. Russia has a convertible currency. There's social media. There's access to the public. They can't clamp down as hard as they used to. Now, not to say that it's fraught with problems, but we've been playing this game for much longer than they have, dealing with multiple sides and multiple incidences. I think it's dependent upon the U.S. and the West to play this very carefully. But we have a distinct advantage. They're not used to being responsive to the rest of the world.
And
that, how do we handle that?
And you're saying the U.S. is. Okay, thank you for that point. And Anders, just in a few seconds, agree, disagree?
Yeah, no, I agree. Right now we are seeing a massive Russian propaganda offensive to the West, but in the end I think that the West will come back.
All right, thank you so much. My guests have been Masha Gessen. She's the author of the book The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Masha, thanks for joining us again from Moscow.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Anders Aslan, Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Thank you for being with us in Washington, Anders.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website at onpointradio.org. And coming up tomorrow, calls for police reforms after officers' shootings, how the conversation is and isn't changing from Ferguson to New York. And again, follow us on Twitter, find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jackie Lydon. I'm in today for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.